There's a film in that.
Oi! Oi!
There's a film in that.
Oi! You're over there, boy in the ball. Oi!
There's a film in that.
Oi! Oi!
There's a film in that.
Oi! You're over there, boy in the ball. There's a film in that.
Hello, and welcome to episode 7 of There's a Film in That.
Oh, a film in that.
God.
As ever, I'm sat here with Tiernan.
Hello.
And Ryan.
Hello.
And today we're going to be tackling the second act.
Whoop, whoop.
Act dos.
Yeah. Tiernan, you sound so ready for this.
I am pumped for this.
Are you tired?
No, not at all.
Busy week?
No. Well, yeah, storm dodging.
Yeah.
I was in Dublin. I was due to fly last Monday, but hurricane / tropical storm / normal Irish storm Ophelia kept me from my flight from departing. So I had to go a day later, a few meetings, putting together a little short film over there. So, yeah.
Who did you fly with?
Flew with one way Ryanair, the other way Aer Lingus.
Which one was better?
Aer Lingus.
Every time, mate. I flew to New York with Aer Lingus.
It's not even a competition, like.
No.
Not even a competition.
Wish it was.
True.
Two planes taking off at the same time.
Ready? Go.
Aer Lingus wins.
Yeah. Spoiler.
You don't have to clap on Aer Lingus, do you?
No, you don't. There is no announcement horn that you arrived early or on time.
I don't want to be forced into clapping at relief that the plane's landed. That annoys me.
Little Birdie told me that you might be up to some kind of athletic challenge in the next week.
Yes, running the Dublin Marathon next weekend.
You know why that's really big?
Yes! What a joke!
This is the worst joke I've ever heard.
Keeps Dublin.
I told Tiernan that joke on the phone the other day.
Yes.
Yeah!
I also received a similar reaction.
Yeah. You could take this opportunity to put out some kind of sponsorship plea.
Well,
so, Ryan, what have you been up to this week?
Well, I was watching Leftovers. Ah!
Oh, that's the one reference out of the way. That's good.
Done it. We've got it out.
Oh, you can just hope that that's it out of the way. I feel we've veered wildly off track already.
Arguably, this is probably more engaging than our content. Yeah.
True. So that was a nice little treat for everyone.
Good.
But
we should probably do our usual section, though, should we? Our recommendations that we didn't watch from before.
I am very excited about this.
I just need to... Hey, oh my God, we're going to recommend things. Oh, I'm in the section of recommended stuff like films.
And we're in a corner.
Oh, shit. We're in a corner. The top corner.
It's recommendation corner.
Beautiful. As always. I would be honest with the little bits of travel and everything like that. I've been rubbish with recommendations apart from scripts.
Oh, yeah?
I did read several scripts.
Were they your own?
No, they were not my own.
I mean, that is... No one specified.
No, I have been going over some of my stuff, but no, I did read A More by Michael Haneke.
Very nice.
Oh,
nice.
Because I thought that was an interesting one to read, because it's... Well, there is a fair bit of dialogue in it, but it's not a massively long script. It's a great film. Won Cannes a few years ago, and I believe won a Best Foreign Film at the Oscars as well.
Is that the one with the old folks?
Yeah. So, amazing film. So I read that, and I also read Magnolia, the P.T. Anderson script that we talked about too much already, but just as a multi-stranded thing, because I was looking at it for our Act 1. I did a couple of... I watched a lot of other good stuff. I'm going to recommend American Vandal already to everyone. Anyone who's into their docs or crime docs, it's a mockumentary version of that about a...
No, it's very much real. I was entirely gripped by it.
It's incredible.
In fact, I binge-watched that in 2 days.
Yeah, I did the same.
Me and my sister tried to watch that Saturday night, and I was well up for watching it, and Michelle was like, this isn't real, and then just didn't want to watch it.
But the reason it works is they treat it like it is real. Mm. And they just... Because I never thought that to anyone listening who hasn't seen the concept, is a high school student expelled for drawing penises on all the teachers' cars. But then they do an 8-part Making a Murder-style breakdown of the whole crime. And when I heard the concept, I thought there's no way that'll carry for more than half an hour. Mm. But incredibly, it does. And
yeah,
it's absolutely
like that
brilliant.
The
best thing
episode
I've seen in a while. And Mindhunters. I also just binge-watched Mindhunters on Netflix, which is another good recommendation. Great dialogue, great characters.
You're off, aren't you?
Getting him in, isn't he?
I tell you, quick fire round this time.
Nice.
Because, I didn't watch any of the recommendations we had, so I'm trying to cover my ass.
Fair enough.
So, but,
what were the recommendations? We had
Doubt.
Doubt, yes. With Nail and I.
That's
and
right.
And No Country for Old Men.
Mm. I read Doubt.
Did you?
Yeah. Very good.
I found it when I was unpacking some stuff for our new flat, and I found it, and I read it. It was great.
Very good.
Yeah.
Nice. I had doubt.
Over what? Film.
Just, you know, in life.
I have
life,
so much doubt.
Life direction.
Very good.
Yeah.
Nice. And did you watch any of the other
Ooh,
ones? No, very good.
We so, are, yeah.
Listeners, make of that what you will.
I think in our
do
defense,
as I say, don't do as I do. Just
in a little second recommendation corner.
I should put you in front of Phil Collins. Oh.
That's, I think that's a more appropriate title than recommendations corner.
Do as I say, not as I do. Welcome to.
I think that better sums up our attitude towards it, certainly. So, but yeah, but in fairness, they were our own like films that we'd all seen before.
Yeah.
So we've all seen them at some stage. So.
And in our defence, we have been doing a lot of writing.
A lot of writing, yeah. We've been launching into Act One. So I guess we should, yeah, do a little Act One update before we do anything else.
Act One update.
I feel we're getting too
act
many
one update,
jingles.
Date, shut up, Tim. We love the Act One update.
It has been very busy culminating in a writer's meeting this morning.
Which is great.
Yeah, it was highly enjoyable.
Very chocolate-fueled.
Chocolate-fueled, yeah. For some reason, we all needed quite a lot of pick-me-ups to get going.
Mm.
But we had projectors up.
And
fervent note-taking.
Yeah, you were live note-taking.
Yeah.
Throwing out ideas, getting them all down.
Interpretive dances.
I believe, looking back, I might have been walking and talking too much. I was up on my feet trying to think and
yeah,
new
treadmill.
Experience for me, but it was good. Laughed at quite a lot, but it bounced off me. I was in bulletproof mode, so it's all good. We'll let that slide today.
Yeah. But it was very pro-productive.
Pro-productive.
Yeah, triple pro.
It was very helpful.
Pro.
And there's probably, yeah, so in reviewing Act One, there's a few things we should probably update everyone on.
It's now set in space.
Set in space. no, there is a few things that we should say. That the first of which was that in the prize that this cul-de-sac has won is a communal garden of the year. And because actually in our writing we discovered that maybe everyone having a separate garden wasn't quite working.
Yeah, we needed a space to bring everyone together, didn't we? Really,
yeah. And if they're sharing the space, it ups the level of conflict, of tension, of potential struggles for them between themselves and the outside world. So we've transported the nice kind of garden space out into the front, into the kind of circular area of the cul-de-sac. We imagine that as being a really nice garden area. And potentially, I believe you threw out some kind of vegetable patch ideas.
Yeah, floral arrangement competition.
Floral arrangement, maybe some sort of Japanese garden area, a little kind of area of zen.
The devil is in the detail, isn't it?
Yeah, I tell you. So it's...
we've just mostly been talking about gardens.
We have been discussing gardens a lot, but and that's still where Earl lives. And there's still ongoing discussions about whether, you know, whether he's been welcomed as part of the garden, and that's kind of almost helped them to win the award by showing their spirit and welcoming Earl into this garden, or whether, you know, whether he came afterwards or when he arrived, that's an ongoing discussion. But the general space that's won the award is a communal space that they all share now.
Earl does like to come last.
He's an unstoppable ladies' machine with his smooth jazz piano and ability to come last.
Good. And as part of our Act One review, we've also had to kind of finesse who our characters symbolise and what they represent on our cul-de-sac as part of our Act One writing. And that's been quite interesting, actually. Mm. So we've tried to pick a theme that each character kind of stands for.
Yeah, we thought it'd be good to explore kind of the world's reaction to this event, this climate change event, through all the different facets of society. So we tried to assign each of them to a character through what we'd worked on before. So we have a little breakdown for each character.
Yeah, so who's up first? I guess let's talk about the Kneebolts, Joanne and Kirsty.
Oh, hey.
Wee baby Kneebolt is going to represent the artistic and creative communities of the world.
Nice. Mm. And Mr. Mikhail Rybakov.
He was the scientific community through his love of weather and technology.
Nice.
What about
God Catman?
Obviously, he does exactly what he says in the tin, the Ronsil of our cul-de-sac. He is representing the religions of the world.
And the felines.
And the cats, yes.
Spencer, the big S?
Well, Spencer, we have a couple of little points on. We had him representing the kind of dark side of technology and progress in the world. through his trolling and his love of computers. But a little teaser for later on in the episode, we've also updated him now to have a degenerative condition.
Mm.
And that ties into a little plot point in Act 2 that we'll soon be discussing. But a little teaser for everyone there.
Nice. How about the LEDs?
The LEDs, they're going to represent the older generations, maybe a bit stuck in their ways, unable to react to events as they should in a timely and effective manner.
Nice. And we have the...
RJ, the big Regina.
The big Regina. She is going to represent, well, what she preaches, hatred, segregation, everything that's wrong with the world in terms of this idea of individuals versus society.
All right, the council worker.
They were going to represent the kind of the everyman. Could represent everyone in society just trying to do their part, get on with life, just live a simple existence, do their job, look after their family, go on holiday, do everything that, you know, just to get on with things.
Nice. Yeah. There's one more to go, isn't there?
One more, Mr. Earl Erner, our force of good on the cul-de-sac. We added a few little character notes for him as well, which were that he's maybe a man in transit. He's travelled around a lot with his jazz, the idea of the old school riding the railways. He's been
a vagabond.
Yeah, around the world, travelling, singing, playing music, but found a little niche he's happy to stay in at the moment with the cul-de-sac and the people and this beautiful garden they've cultivated. So he's just in a little rest period of in his life, but he's crossed paths with the cul-de-sac. But he's representing the forces of good in the world. Yeah, we've kind of assigned that those characteristics to all our characters now and what they represent to help us move forward.
Excelente.
And I think one of the things that we have worked out from the past week of writing is, I think we've started to feel a little bit more confident with where the story's going. And in some ways, we've had to kind of look at the story as a whole and look at how we want to end it. And we've used that as a catalyst to working out how to best develop the first act.
Mm.
And I think that's probably, and we haven't really touched on that previously, but I guess that's important for everyone to know where they're driving towards.
Mm.
I think the lesson there is not to be afraid of jumping forwards in the story to kind of give yourself a perspective and a goal to drive towards.
Mm. Well, it's and you know, being honest about doing this as a podcast and writing as we're going along and everything, that's one of the challenges, isn't it? That we're discovering that by trying to keep it fresh and exciting and have a story as we're telling a story, that it was making it harder for us. And we actually, by having this meeting today and jumping ahead and being a bit more focused and knowing where we're going with it, it'll hopefully make the writing easier. Because it was exciting to see, like, not knowing potentially what we all bring to the table each week, but it has made it hard, hasn't it?
Yeah.
So, it's been a little struggle at times, but that's part of any script process.
We did say at the beginning as well that there was going to be frustrating times, and I think this is definitely the first big frustrating moment we've had trying to work out where we were going with our story. So it was great. It was great to know that we all actually, when it came to it, we had the exact same idea as well.
Mm.
And we all agreed where we're going. So as a collaborative side from that, if you're not just writing on your own, if you are, as we're doing, writing in more than one person, having that open line of communication and expressing your ideas and being open to see where it goes in different ways is, when you're stuck and talking about that, is the best thing you can do.
Mm.
And not being afraid to go, actually, one idea favours the story better than the other, or, you know, as the expression goes, kill your babies if there's one bit you really like, but you know it's not helping anything, chop it out.
Mm. I mean, we should say that we both were incredibly frightened of Tiernan and the repercussions that might fall of challenging any of his ideas.
I was the last to arrive and there was a very nervous room awaiting me.
Tiernan came in looking like Daniel Day-Lewis in...
Gangs in New York. Please say Gangs in
New York. Came in with a giant...
My left foot.
Yeah. And then we had the idea for the guy with the wasting disease. Tiernan did come in looking like he was going to kill us. No, he didn't. That's all lies. He came in with a big beaming face, chuffed as beans, and then we were like, Tiernan, we need to talk.
I thought I was out, guys. I'm just happy to still be on the podcast. You should have seen that. I thought I was out.
It's not me, it's you.
Why are you two wearing those matching hats? No reason, Tiernan.
they went and bought hats on me.
Indeed.
Intervention. Leftover intervention.
Speaking of rough times, the people of the leftovers.
Right, that's it, get out. We warned you.
But no, but yeah. And so, was there anything else with Act One? I think, yeah. So we again a similar concept with we're going around introducing all the characters through the process of the letters. In that letters, it was saying they'd won this award mm-hmm. as kind of cul-de-sac garden of the year. Then it went on to a meeting / celebratory drinks that night where it was announced a little secret extra was that as part of their winning package, they were going to get a television expose in possibly a month later. There was going to be a film crew coming. So they have to therefore maintain the garden, maintain their relationships, keep things going for another month to try and ensure that the garden looks great for television and their cul-de-sac is well represented.
Which actually... at the end of that leads us into Act Two, doesn't it?
Yeah, that was the end of our Act One, but again, still the same lock-in that the TV crew were coming. They have to do this, so they are locked into maintaining this garden and maintaining our story.
Yeah.
So yeah, maybe that is a good place to jump into today's episode, which is Act Two.
Act Two.
Dos cerveza.
Por favor. Okay, so diving into Act Two, we've done a little bit of research, as we always enjoy doing, and we've come up with a few core concepts that constitute a powerful Act Two, the first of which is obstacles.
Yeah.
Something's in my way!
Step round it.
Oh, I'm round it.
Live improvising of obstacles. That's the level we've reached now.
Yep.
I mean, that's the
spectacular podcasting.
Zero subtext.
No, yeah, they're a massive part of any good Act Two stuff that is put in our protagonist character's way for them to overcome. And then, and it just ups the tension, ups the. There's no point like jumping straight to the big boss at the end or the fight at the end. There needs to be henchmen to overcome.
True.
You know, different elements of the story that, like, little. Smaller obstacles before it leads up to the big thing.
Like the boss at the end of a level.
Yeah. Oh, very much like a video game. There's all the little henchmen, everything you have to overcome first before you fight the big boss at the end.
What's your favourite second level in a computer game?
God.
What's that one in Sonic 2? I quite like that one.
Eggman.
No, he's not called Eggman. He's Dr. Robotnik. I hate that.
Eggman.
Not Eggman.
I don't fucking know.
I like Sonic 2 had a good one. What was that? Aztec? No, that's
Goldeneye.
That's Crystal Maze. Goldeneye had a good second level. Yeah.
What was that?
Facility? Well, they're on the bridge at the top on the first one, aren't they?
That's how do you remember this?
Second one was wasn't it like the archive or something?
I think it's Facility, wasn't it?
The Facility.
Yeah,
it's Facility.
My God.
Yeah, because he dives in, doesn't he, to the thing, and then he goes into the facility. Yeah,
that's right.
Second level. Yeah, well done.
I've got an open competition this week with my housemate, Johnny, who thinks he can beat me at Goldeneye on the N64. Yeah. And if he does, he gets some of my vinyl record collection.
Oh, wow. Lots on the line. What do you get if you win?
Some of his vinyl record collection.
Oh, okay, fair enough.
Fair trade.
Yeah, seems legit.
You've got no chance, Johnny.
Shit, that's a cliffhanger for next
episode.
That is a
cliffhanger. I want to know about that. I want to enter this competition.
No.
Now, hold on. Are you playing as Oddjob?
No, but that is what Matthew Lamonby, who should be listening, does. So
yes,
pretty unfair tactics.
No one should be Oddjob. Not
but,
even Oddjob.
Back to obstacles.
Yeah,
he's an obstacle.
He is. He's an ex-wrestler.
Yeah, and he's very good at throwing a hat.
Yeah, he's a shoe. One thing we said, you said about except like henchmen and other ones, but there are other kinds of obstacles, aren't there, Tierney?
Oh, of course, yeah. Sorry, that was just one example of many different kinds of obstacles.
There's an internal obstacle.
Ooh, what does that mean?
Well, it could mean something that has something to do with their past and they're trying to overcome. So it could be that maybe they have to do a bungee jump, but they're afraid of heights because when they were kids, they jumped off a hill. That's an internal obstacle right there.
Yeah, it could be. Yeah, something like they're struggling to commit to a relationship because of a past breakup or something like that. Any inner turmoil can also be an obstacle to the continuation of the story. So normally there's a first attempt at these, so the character will try to overcome them, often successfully, I would guess, because otherwise the story. Well, yeah, they can. Fuck it up, I guess, but it has to be redeemable. It can't be. They can't fail so much that the story ends.
Yeah.
But there's like a lot of. I tell you, a great film to watch, or any type of film to watch when it comes to identifying obstacles, is any sport film. or predominantly like a Rocky film or Mighty Ducks.
Great film. Into
that. Yeah, great film. But any that type of thing, because they have a first attempt. Or even in the case of maybe Rocky, if you think about it, Rocky 1 was having to fight Apollo Creed, lost the first time. Go again. Did he beat him in the second one? Wait, is that...
I'm just trying to remember what the basketball film with the cartoon characters
was. Space Jam.
Space Jam.
Thank you. Yeah, it's really hurting me.
Great film.
So
great soundtrack.
Yeah. R. Kelly?
Multiple people. It was a very diverse soundtrack. It was good.
Interesting fact, they've not changed their website since the film was made. Wow. If you were to put in Space Jam on Google and look at it, it is still old as fuck.
Wow.
I'm going to do that.
Nice.
Recommendation. The first one I'll listen to.
Yeah. Easy one to do.
Go and look at spacejam.com.
I think it's even .net.
Wow.
Who owns that? Sony? Well, Warner Brothers, isn't it? Because it's all the cartoon characters.
There's definitely a first attempt and then ramifications to whatever, whether they manage to overcome their obstacle or whether they fail in a positive manner but regroup to come back again.
So the next concept that came up in our research is subplot, which, as we all know, stands for sublimation plotage.
Oh.
Ouais le bibliothèque.
Where'd you learn that?
France land.
Ooh, very fancy pants.
I'm very fancy.
Nice. Bons, well, I guess you could also call that, if you're not speaking French, you could also call that secondary plot.
Nah.
No? Okay.
You could tell the English versus the French.
Improv wouldn't work well with you, would it?
Nah.
Shutting stuff down.
So what's the subplot, Ryan?
It's when things happen underneath the other plot. You want more than that, don't you?
No.
No, yes, secondary plots. So things that aren't... the main story can often be a romantic kind of interest or something that happens that isn't driving your main story forward, but is also something that character or characters have to deal with. And good secondary or subplots often intertwine and interlink with the main plot.
Can you pick out a particular example for me?
I've got a good one.
Okay.
Die Hard. Captain John McClane. I think he's a captain. John McClane. Is flying from New York, where he's based as a cop, to LA to see his wife. And then it all kicks off being Hans Gruber won his 20% and taking over the Yakatomi building, all that stuff. Yakatomi?
I think so.
Or Nakatomi?
Nakatomi.
Whatever. It's a building that basically they want to get lots of money from. And the subplot is that he's actually, obviously, that's the initial. Reason he's going is to see his wife and reconnect with her. She's working out in LA. He's in New York. They probably didn't speak last time on good terms. So he's come over to spend time with her, and then the main plot kicks in, which is the lock-in, right? When the main plot
of the terrorists taking over the building and having them both trapped inside.
Yeah. So then the subplot actually is quite nice because it feeds in. Obviously, it's still a girl. It's still a guy trying to save a girl, essentially. And that's still like his objective is to save her and everyone else. But the subplot is him wanting to reconnect. And that's kind of done at the beginning. And it also is used as quite decent plot points as well, I think, throughout the film.
Well, it's a good example because obviously they could have technically done that whole him and his wife over the phone. She could have been elsewhere, but by putting her in the building as well, that's a good example of making the two plots, the main plot of the terrorist and the subplot of his relationship with her, interlink. So that's why that's probably a pretty good example of it.
Very clever as well, because obviously she went over, she went over to work in this company and just went back to her maiden name, and that was explained through plot, which meant that they couldn't have been connected until the third act. Mm. By picture. I mean, on her table there's a picture of her.
Yeah,
I still can't remember her name. That's pissing me off.
So that's a good example of subplot. Can it often be romantic? Doesn't have to be romantic. Can be a technical aspect. Can be a variety of different things. Not always romantic, but it's the secondary plot that supports and interlinks with the main plot. So yeah.
And I think that brings us on to first culmination. Would you like to explain what that is, Tina?
Well, could be called the midpoint of the film, and it's where something, whatever the characters overcome in their obstacles, whether they've succeeded or failed, they've learned something from it, and it allows them to kick on and kick the plot on for the rest of the film, leading up to the resolution of the second act, and sending them into the climax of the film, whether that be saving someone on, you know.
Unlocking. Is that a bit like Luke Skywalker and Han Solo rescuing Princess Leia from the clutches of evil Vader, although they still have to destroy the Death Star?
Look at that.
That is amazing.
That example just rolled off out of your brain. Head, yeah. Yeah, I was going to say. Yeah.
There's another. I just thought another actually good one is, it's kind of a subplot, but in Saving Private Ryan, there's a subplot in dialogue between all the characters of what Tom Hanks's real job is. And they have a pool, they have a bet on what, they no one can work it out. And they say, what's the bet up to? And that comes in when the interpreter, after they storm the beaches, don't they?
Yeah.
The German interpreter come along and they're trying to work out what his job is. And that actually leads back in later on to quite an important monologue with Tom Hanks explaining what his job is. And I think he's talking to Matt Damon at that point, isn't he? Yeah. And that's kind of a nice, because it shows there's a realness to the characters. So it's good that, I mean...
Yeah, it captures the camaraderie, I guess, of the whole crew as well. Like, so their main plot is obviously to save Private Ryan. Giveaway of the title. but they also have this, because he's not in the film for most of it, he only gets there at the end, this magical Private Ryan. So the actual subplot there of them and how they interact on this journey and Tom Hanks's character and his history, yeah, it's a nice one as well. Yeah, and obviously not very romantic.
No, so true.
That's a good example.
True. Yeah. Whilst we're talking examples, are there any particular second acts that you guys would like to highlight?
I've got two.
Nice.
The one that popped in my head earlier was Full Metal Jacket, because the film is split up in three stages, I guess, and the first one being with a boot camp with Private Pyle and all of that debacle going on.
Oh, nice.
Thanks. And the second one is
Full Metal Debacle.
Full Metal. And the second act is you seeing them being more accustomed to the environment that they're in and where they are and fighting. And the fact that actually at that point they're probably not... There's a lot less of the fighting going on. The last act is, I think it's in Hanoi, and is the standoff between the sniper and the remaining squad. Call them a squad?
Yeah.
So I did like that set as a second act. And I think Kubrick does have a bit of an unconventional way of looking at acts anyway. In films, in that respect, I mean, Space Odyssey. Maybe. Is there a second act on that? I know it's done kind of by the monoliths and what have you, but it's hard to that kind of. And I think when you watch a film that doesn't have a specific second act, that's good for an audience to go, okay, where's this going, and how does it lead back, and it keeps you engaged. My other one is my favourite one is The Goonies, because The Goonies is just an adventure story of some kids trying to find treasure. And the first act being them finding the map and trying to save, get the money so they can save where they live and their whole street and all that stuff. And then they get locked in by having been trapped in the kind of old beach diner.
Yeah, the cafe.
The cafe, isn't it? Yeah. And they have to go underground because the gang of misfits, the Fratellis, are coming back to like their hideout. And they have to hide, so they then go on there, which means they can't go back. They have to keep going forward, thus getting in, having to sort out all the booby traps.
Booby traps,
literal obstacles.
Yeah. Just a cup of butt.
But it's their time down there.
No, it's our time up here doing a podcast.
Nice. What about yourself, T? Any examples?
Well, actually, when Ryan was talking about Full Metal Jacket, they reminded me of one I saw recently, Hacksaw Ridge.
It's okay.
Got some good. Another war film. War films often have, because I guess it depends. There's a bit of genre stuff in here as well, I guess, in that if you've got a war film or something like that, yeah, technically and filmmaking and visual wise, you're setting up in your opening act a character or a story or circumstances that lead to war. And Act Two is where you really get to go to town on your visuals and everything else. And Axel Ridge was good for that. Has some nice stuff both at the army camp where they're training and all the battle he goes through legally in order to join the war and to join his company, and then also the early battle scenes before he locks into the final one. So that was one. But then the other one I was thinking of ahead of time was Interstellar, the Chris Nolan epic.
I thought you were talking about the porno. Interstellar.
Oh, lovely. I must check that out tonight. There's our first recommendation of the week, everyone. So obviously Earth dying, and they have to go out and find a new place for humans to colonize. But they literally have different planets being different obstacles there. The first one being the planet they go down eventually, which is water and a giant wave. And then, they end up losing a man there, losing 30 years or something of Earth time with the gravitational time warp or whatever it is. So like there's an obstacle there, which is going to the planet and working out if anyone's alive and they can live there. And then there's an attempt to do it and go there and work it out. And the ramifications are all the time they lose. So that's a good, like there's really broken up by planet that one, but it works
was
quite
it,
well.
Was it the loss of time that really annoyed you about that, Ryan?
No, it wasn't. I'll tell you what annoyed me was the bloody water planet. Because if it looked, it's misleading. It looked like the water was really deep, and it was shallow, wasn't it?
Is that their notes reporting back to NASA's waiting for the update? Oh, really annoying. It looked deep. It's really deep.
Like, what if they like were being really cavalier about getting in the water, and they climbed on top of their ship? Which, by the way, you only saw like the panel of it for half of that bit in water world. And they climb on top
what?
With a landing water world.
What did yeah, that
okay,
water
watch world? That film again. And all you see is when they're actually landing on there is half of the ship. Not even half, like a quarter. Like it's as if someone has just gone on the side of a train and just filmed a bit of a train going near water.
Okay.
Just watch it again. Anyway, sorry, back this to made my, you so my grievance angry. About this film. And they jump, and if they jump in, they're going to hurt themselves. And I've done my head in. I just think that's stupid. I know it's probably meant to be shallow, but it's misleading.
I've seen the behind the scenes of film, and that's very cool.
I don't care.
It would have been cooler if it was deeper.
I was trying to soften the blow, but sorry, I guess not.
No.
But yeah.
I'm angered. Nolan. Well,
moving swiftly on then. Any for you, Ash?
No.
No? You're not a fan of Act 2? Just give you a beginning and an ending?
I'm more of a, first act kind of guy.
First act kind of guy.
Ash cheats at Street Fighter, that's why.
That's what your missus says. Oh. I don't even know what that means.
I don't know either. Burn. Or not.
But yeah.
Moving swiftly onwards.
Yeah.
How are we going to apply these concepts that we've learned so much about to our own
Look
film?
At us just seamlessly segueing into these next
sections.
Segway.
So I guess obstacles. Let's start there, shall we?
Yeah. We got to talk about the hosepipe that launched 1,000 ships, nice. Which is the hosepipe, and specifically the ban of them. That's going to be our first obstacle. That was in the initial pitches way back in episode 1. It's always been an obstacle on our horizon. That's going to be the first one. So if you're thinking Act 1 ends with them having this meeting where the TV expose showcase is announced, and then shortly after that, it can also be announced that due to this endless heat wave they're in, it is now full-on hosepipe ban time. And that obviously would have ramifications for being able to water this communal garden, and that it would all deteriorate if they can't somehow maintain it and water it. So that's what they've got to overcome. Which leads us nicely into our teaser from earlier, which was Spencer Tompkins' disability.
Mm.
Which, Ryan, do you want to shed light on this?
Yeah, we had a bit of a eureka moment with our Spencer Tompkins character, because we were chatting about if Spencer had some kind of disability or anything that would confine him to his room at God Catman's house, because he didn't want to get involved, and he felt like he couldn't get involved, and that just festers up this resentment for World, hence the trolling and all that stuff. Was actually something we found out prior to thinking up this with the character, is that if in real life, if there is a hosepipe ban and there is someone in your household that has some kind of disability, it essentially waivers the hosepipe ban, which means you can actually use water on anything you want. That does depend obviously on councils and stuff, but it was something which actually brought light to our function for with Spencer Tompkins, really, doesn't it?
Yeah, it was a bit circular in the end, because we thought that if Spencer had a disability, he'd be in his room in his role, but it would give us a nice subplot that he would, in order to overcome this obstacle of the hosepipe ban, they would try and coax Spencer out of hiding to be more part of the community, more involved with the gun, and thus be able to get the hosepipe ban waived. So then it had served two plot points, as says, their way of overcoming this obstacle, this initial obstacle, and it also brings one of our characters out a bit more, which would cause conflict for him, maybe more conflict in the cul-de-sac. And so, yeah, it could be a really nice plot point. So we were quite pleased with that when it all came together.
Yeah.
So that would be our first obstacle, though, and a successful first attempt to overcome it, which I think by being successful in this occasion, it would hopefully be quite nice, because obviously in the grander scheme of things, they've got this horrendous climate change event that the hosepipe ban is ultimately going to prove a little futile.
And I guess that brings us on to our second obstacle, which is a little bit more final,
right? Yeah.
Being that we think someone's going to have to kick the bucket.
Yeah. We thought the midpoint, I think, is really the first death. Has to be. We always talked about killing off people. We can't leave that too late in our film. We don't want a sudden massacre at the end. It's got to be, you know...
It begins now.
Yeah.
Mm.
So we've had a long discussion about this, haven't we?
We have.
About who should go first. I mean, this will be always be the challenge going forward now about who's going when. But we thought, who do we think was the kind of the unofficial leader of the... The communal garden?
Papa Led.
Papa it? Led.
Yeah. Big G.
Big G Led.
Yeah.
We thought actually Valerie and Gerald would be driving the garden, especially Gerald, well, I guess, with his naval background, man of discipline, a man of authority. He'd be taking the lead when it came to the goals. Obviously, we got the council worker, but they're more an admin kind of organisational side of things, maybe a mouthpiece for the cul-de-sac, but not in terms of actually running the garden.
If, when it comes to it, and we see Papa Led die, I think he has to be wearing a red jumper.
Okay.
Cliffhanger of the week. We thought that for a number of reasons, primarily being that actually it will cause the most conflict and most stress to the rest of our residents if the leader of that side of things is to fall first.
Yeah.
You kind of don't want someone whose death would be inconsequential to the greater story. If you put like the figurehead of the garden, if he goes, then yeah, it puts everyone else under a lot of stress and pressure, and who's going to step up to take his place? How's Valerie going to react?
Because we thought she would probably cling on to the competition, right? To the flower show.
Yeah, I think it would become more important than ever to her. It takes on the effect of Gerald's legacy in her head, that she would want to throw her grief into something, along with honouring her fallen comrade. So that could be the first death, we think, as the midpoint. Which then, I guess, things will start to really kick off very quickly then. Because the other thing that death symbolises, perhaps, is that, you know, ultimately this televised showcase of the gun doesn't really matter. There are bigger things at play here. And we thought that would be this first death is the way to open up everyone's reactions to what's going on, and that this heat wave is actually quite extreme. People would start to worry about their own health, the health of those around them, and maybe what's also causing this climate change event.
Baby Jesus.
He's personally responsible. Plot twist. A new character has been announced. Baby Jesus.
He's a...
Baby Nebot's cousin.
Baby Nebot's cousin, yeah. Baby Jesus.
So drawing on our character list from earlier, this obstacle is going to really up everyone's game. And I think we need to look at how each character will deal with the new set of obstacles and circumstances. Mm. So should we start with God Catman?
Yeah, well, I suppose God Catman will react in a like a religious figure we'd expect him to. He'd latch on to prayer, dedication, questioning God as to why people are dying and why there's no rain. And maybe we thought he's also, to create more conflict in the cul-de-sac, he'd maybe take on the role of trying to expose the sinners.
Yeah, and trying to get people to repent, I suppose.
A bit like a passive-aggressive witchfinder general.
Yes.
Very true, yeah. Yeah, no, he that's what he would do. He'd be aware of historical secrets from the cul-de-sac, things that happen between affairs and families and backstories, and he'd start to try and expose people and get God somehow, the kind of the ancient old idea of, you know, sacrifice and truth bringing about the end of this religious punishment as he sees it.
Like the Old Testament God Catman.
Yeah. He goes,
at the beginning, we've got a New Testament God Cat Man.
Yeah.
By the end, we've got an Old Testament God Cat Man.
Yeah. He goes back to the old.
Back to the roots.
The fundamentals of sacrifice and, exposing people. So, we thought that, and he could create a lot of tension there.
Yeah.
And it obviously, and like, again, no disrespect meant, but probably some taken, but that people who are very keen on religion can really be very, they can believe that. They could be very strong in their beliefs. He would definitely believe that what he's doing is righteous and just. And,
so almost moulding the scenario to fit his views, kind of thing.
Exactly.
Taking it as validation.
Mm. Yeah.
Whereas perhaps there would be some characters on the cul-de-sac who would in some way seek to use it to their advantage. Mm.
Yeah, so like Joanne and Kirsty Niebuhr might actually use this as a way of progressing in their arts. In the weirdest way, I guess, to put it. I think Joanne could be the unblocking of a writer's block. She started documenting what's happening with this community that have won this competition and are being celebrated for it. And now with the death, it's just added something in for her, which means a promotion for her. Plus, she has a day job on the radio, so having that as a mouthpiece as well is only going to intensify things. If you look at how nowadays, how even back in the before that, you know, how big events happening in the world are, they're not. Some media might glamorize it or make it larger than it actually is, and that's something which is something to consider as an influence to everyone on the cul-de-sac. And then Kirsty, I mean, she'll be using that. From initially, she'd probably be using it anyway, won't she? Mm. You know,
she wants more followers and more views and everything else. So if she used, she would see it as a chance to gain more exposure, like a death on the cul-de-sac. And and I think maybe, you know, we're looking at the bigger picture of what's going on. I quite like the idea that they also think they're doing this, and maybe locally they are getting some more exposure. But in the wider world, this is happening everywhere. So actually, when you understand the full story, it's kind of inconsequential in a way.
Mm.
And also I quite like when you're saying that. I wonder whether Joanne's book is like, for some reason, it could be like an amazing erotica. I just like had this like
Mills and Boone.
Like it's a hot summer and people are dying on the cul-de-sac and there's a sexy detective in town. I don't know why my mind went there, but I thought she could be writing a really good erotic novel.
Tinning trousers around his ankles.
I'm really uncomfortable with this.
So she'd certainly be trying to take advantage of it.
How do you think the council worker would deal with it? Would he be trying to cancel the flower show, the garden competition?
I mean, this is something we were discussing earlier. I think, Lucy, and I think he still works as a mouthpiece for other people. I think in a weird way, he is a yes man. But he's the mouthpiece for maybe some of the other residents on the cul-de-sac.
Well, yeah, I think I'd agree with that. I think he might have he'd have some maybe mixed views on it in terms of having to deal with a death on the cul-de-sac and maybe the exposure and the stress that would bring for him. But I think maybe the idea, if we want everyone to have bought into this idea of the flower show and the TV expose as a reward, I imagine the council world also bought into that.
Yeah.
It's a great, like, he or she lives on this cul-de-sac. It's a great, like, feather in the cap for them. So, and if they were to try and cancel it, I think that would bring a world of stress upon them from the other residents.
Yeah.
Like, don't shit where you eat, like.
Yeah.
So that they wouldn't want to anger people and have to deal with the repercussions of that. So they'd leave it on someone else to cancel if it ever was going to be cancelled, in my opinion.
And then I guess Mikhail is probably nervous about the additional exposure this will bring. I don't know whether he already kind of has an idea of what's going on. So this is the first real vindication of, you know, his theories that it's all not going to go very well for people.
Yeah. No, yeah, certainly he's... there's a couple of things with Mikhail, and we won't spoil anything. We have some... from our discussion, we have some good chats about where this could all go now, but... I guess the question with Mikhail is, with his expertise and what he's up to in his basement with his weather maps and his technology, that whether he potentially has any way to stop it. That would be the big question with him. whether the kind of the death makes him double down in his research or his planning. But then there's also the other aspect of him, which we talked about, was his preparations, his stockpiling food and water and filling up his bunker. So hopefully, I think the death would accelerate both of those things for him, along with maybe his isolation. But I mean, there could also be a really good subplot as to whether someone discovers his history on the cul-de-sac, what he's up to, wonders why he's stockpiling, and they understand that he's a weatherman and he can maybe shed some light on what's going on. So maybe the death would also accelerate that subplot, so that he's forced to... Because again, similar to Spencer, we have to think of how to get him out and about interacting with people. Yeah. So if he's exposed, possibly by God Catman in his righteous ways, then he's forced to answer questions about the weather, or certainly try to avoid answering questions about the weather.
I mean, it could even be that Spencer uncovers something, God Catman finds it out, sees...
I mean, he's taken all that ridicule online, hasn't he?
Yeah.
So
he's in Spencer territory.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's that.
I guess that obstacle as well, or at least the first death, could mark a real change in feel for the film. So it can go from something quite comedic and potentially lighthearted through to something that suddenly starts to become really sinister and perhaps continues to travel down that path.
Yeah.
It could be a real turning point in terms of genre in some ways, I suppose.
Yeah. I mean, that's a challenge for us, because we did say, when we said previously, that a comedy is where we're going with this, a black comedy, and I mean, that's probably, if that's the way we're going, and that's, we're on the right track. It's just, we'll find that balance, and that'd be great.
Is it, the other thing I guess is interesting though, talking about that tonal shift, your writing can affect things looking backwards as well. I think, I guess we've got to avoid is to try to be too lighthearted in act one, that it feels like a weird tonal shift in act two, that actually when we know our act two and act three, we'll have to feed that back into act one, so it doesn't feel like suddenly it's a completely different film. It's also a backwards process, that they inform each other, that we'd have to maybe, you know, and certainly with what we talked about and done so far in act one, there's dark moments that suggest that the tone to come, but we don't want it to be too lighthearted at the start, so suddenly when people start dying and people get exposed, and you're not like, sorry, what the hell is happening? But
makes me think of the shift in Life is Beautiful, which I think you talked about earlier.
Yeah, I watched that this week, actually, for the first time. That was
it's great, isn't it?
It's lovely, isn't it? It's a wonderful beginning.
It was pitched to me in that
I've only ever seen the first 15 minutes.
I was kind of aware of it, and I've seen clips. Yeah, it's very bad that I hadn't watched it up to this point, but it was pitched to me that it would be sad at a point. But half an hour in, I was like, how and when is this going to get sad? And my God.
Yeah, no really, spoilers.
Yeah.
That is probably one of the best recommendations you've ever done.
Yeah.
Such a good film.
Incredible film.
Have we already recommended it?
Great second act in that, actually. Yeah, amazing obstacles and attempts and ramifications of everything that happens. So let's recommend that as a great act two. And a great film overall. But it's certainly, they handle that tonal shift well. With something we'd have to be aware of as we go into darker and darker territory. So, so that'll affect our act one, looking back, and probably in the rewrites, once we've done a whole act two and act three, we'll go back and look at our act one to make sure it's not all over the shop.
We've still got a few more left, haven't we, on our list, I believe.
Of characters to go through, I guess we've got Regina Jones and family.
Mm. Yep.
It's whether, I mean, there's potentially, is she like, maybe there's a certain element of God Catman to Regina in that, you know, what does she believe is causing this weather, and does she blame a particular race or group of people or part of society for this, and does it inform her hate preaching, and as a result of this and the tension on the card, is she more comfortable in coming forward and voicing her views? Quite like the idea, for instance, she might blame Earl and go into some battle with him.
Yeah.
And we talked a little bit before about finding a slight kindred spirit in Gerald. But not necessarily. But so maybe she's lost a little bit of an ally if Gerald goes first, or does that embolden her? Was Gerald holding her back, and that emboldens her to start pushing her agenda a bit more?
Maybe, yeah.
So maybe she, with her kind of authoritarian view on life, steps forward to
fill the void.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And that could spark conflict with Valerie. And all sorts.
Yeah, whoever's controlling the garden is controlling the cul-de-sac, essentially, isn't it?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, there's a bit of tactical war games going on here, isn't there?
Yeah.
So I think she would. She's certainly got to become more emboldened at one point. There's no point having her being a hate preacher and no one knowing about it, and it never coming to the fore. So I think at some point she's got to.
I feel like I'm sure that will be covered in Act One, from what I've read.
there's some interesting Supple. Saluting going on in Act One.
Subtext, I believe.
But yeah, so I think that death has got to embolden her in some way and set her on a collision course with the rest of the cul-de-sac.
But if she does, I guess you raise a good point. If she does perhaps raise a vendetta against Earl, that brings us to how would Earl perhaps deal with the obstacle? We see him as having just a kind of like a unfaltering sunny disposition in some ways, being the good on the cul-de-sac, was I believe how we described him.
Yeah. But yeah, so, and I think we talked before about with the weather and everything else, so whether the death is the point for someone to step up and try to help Earl and bring him in from the weather.
Yeah.
So whether God Catman in his quest to, you know, be the salvation, is does he step up and invite Earl to live with him? Does Earl want that? Does Earl want to leave the cul-de-sac? Does he...
Valerie's got half a spare bed now.
Yeah.
Saying.
No, that's scandalous. Ooh, Mrs. Lead. She won't be filled with lead anymore.
Just some jazz penis.
I think he has some decisions to make, doesn't he? But I quite like the idea that I think actually, and whether there's any earlier conflict with him, whether with the TV coming, whether he's also an obstacle in certain people's eyes, whether they feel he's good for the look of the cul-de-sac, and that they're, you know, people think it's great that, you know, this will look even better for the fact, genuinely or, you know, or not, just trying to look good, but they think, oh, it's great that Earl's on the green, and it makes us look like we're so generous, and we're looking after him, and we're welcoming to everyone, and whether some people like the TV cameras come and we need Earl to fuck off, basically.
Right.
Yeah.
So actually, he's probably an obstacle and the source of conflict along the way as well.
Yeah, that's true.
So
I think the only other person we haven't touched on is the internet troll.
Well, we kind of did earlier on, talking about his, with this being coaxed out. But I guess from the point of Gerald getting died and all that, there is the blatantly obvious thing that he would do, which is go straight to his computer and troll the shit out of it. To what end that would do and what good that would do, who knows, but that would definitely have some impact later on if God Catman finds out what he's doing. And
I was going to say, if God Catman on his righteous march discovers what his house, maybe Kirsty puts up a
social media memorial page
and he shits all over it
to try and leverage it, and then he shits all over it.
And if God Catman is to discover that, then on his rampage he would want his tenant, that's the word I was looking for, the tenant in Spencer, out of the house.
He would want his tenant to have penance.
And that rhymes.
Right.
Maybe then Spencer moves in with Valerie along with Earl, and our spin-off series is the three of them in a post-apocalyptic world having the lols.
Lolling their faces off.
Lol.
Three's company.
So what would be... don't know why I try. So in terms of first resolution, have we kind of touched on that? So we'll be looking for some kind of Act Two resolution, not of obviously the bigger issues, but perhaps... I guess we had that a little bit with the hosepipe ban, but I don't know whether or not there is anything else that we should touch on there.
Well, I think, I say, other people have then gone to start... dying, and there's
that's not a great resolution,
not,
is it?
It's not, but I mean, or I'm slightly backtracking what I said here earlier, is potentially is Gerald's the only natural death, and other deaths could potentially come from the chaos his death creates. So people starting to take vengeance against each other, and the heat getting to them, you know, if the hose pipe ban is taken off the table because there's literally no more water for a hose pipe, never mind that they have access to it, but if the reservoirs have run dry, if the reservoirs have run dry, then they've got other problems, haven't they?
Yeah.
And I'm thinking maybe Mr. Mikhail Rybakov has a fuckload of provisions somewhere. Wow. Things could start to kick off in that way. If trolls are discovered, if
Rybakov, Michael Fish, oh, giving it away. Sorry, there you go. Or if Rybakov actually ends up killing the wrong person, but the threat of exposure, like I said earlier about with God Catman, if God Catman meets his end through him because he doesn't want to be found out and he doesn't want that stuff, then that's one option, isn't it? But I think a death directly caused by the weather sparks the death and a natural deaths after that. It's a resolution for some entity, but maybe that's what will go into the last act. I think it's a challenge for us for resolution at the second act, being it multi-stranded in this respect. And actually, that's okay. I think if we find out where the conflict is, resolution is going to happen for 50% of the cul-de-sac through those rucks. There's a good. I've got a recommendation which actually I thought about this just before we carry on, which kind of links into this. Is a Stephen King book and it's a film called Needful Things, which didn't realise this, but as we've been talking about it, has quite similar tones. And there was never necessarily a resolution. I mean, there was at the end, but there isn't with what happened with the conflict. It doesn't always work out the way you expect it. And that's what we would, I think, as writers, we don't necessarily want to throw out an expected resolution either for the third act, because the third act ultimately is climax, isn't it?
Yeah. No, and actually, I'm thinking of, I know we've talked about it before, but thinking of my favourite multi-strander, which we've discussed, is Magnolia. I think we mentioned it once or twice, but there's a massive scene in that. All I'll say is, similar to ours, rain, not quite water, but there's a, I won't spoil it for anyone.
Frogs.
Oh, for fuck's sake. But yes, it rains frogs, but that is a great, it's an amazing scene for one, but it actually unifies everyone and their stories. So, and then you see the climax, the ramifications, the resolution to that afterwards as the end of their second act potentially. So the other alternative we have is to have a unifying event.
Yep.
Whether that be, and I mean, it could be something like taking the communal garden off the table. If that burns out, a little wildfire or something like that.
Yeah.
That actually, you know.
Or arson.
Yeah, exactly. Or something that wipes out the initial.
Weed killer.
Yeah, exactly. Wipes out the initial goal and cumulative want that they had.
Weed killer with wheelchair tracks. Who done it?
Imagine it's not Spencer. Someone's nicked his wheelchair. Commits Harry Carey in the middle of the Japanese garden.
All the piano gets smashed up.
Oh, now fucking hell!
See,
that's, take it easy, mate.
Wow, but this is what can happen if it's in that thing at the beginning of the first act, and second act we see this community garden get absolutely ruined.
Yeah, because actually we should have included that earlier. That was a little note that we thought the piano, now speaking of Earl, is potentially a part of this lovely communal garden, along with having maybe children's play areas and the vegetables and everything else. That's their little music area. Yeah. They put one of those freestanding pianos in the garden to encourage the children of the cul-de-sac and the creative people, everyone really, to play on the piano. And I think that's how Earl comes into it. But my God, if the piano is the unifying thing, the real symbol of the centre, especially if Earl's been giving us the soundtrack throughout. That alone, or as part of the garden, that's quite nice. So that would set us up for, this is no longer about the, you know, the TV show and the flower show and the communal garden, the award. It's now about survival in this climate change event for Act 3, and potentially the big fight or the end battle that's going to kick off. That could be a really nice closing resolution to Act Two. What do you think, Ash?
I think that brings it all together really nicely, Tiernan. Thanks. And speaking of tone shift and development, it's time for this week's interview.
Exciting.
Isn't it?
Who we got?
So after our off-air debate about the look and feel of our cul-de-sac, and whilst we were drilling further down into our characters, I thought it might be quite handy for us to have a chat with James Lewis. James is a production designer and an art director, and he's been visualising scripts for quite a long time. We managed to catch him on his lunch break at Shepperton Studios. Apologies for the poor Skype quality, but here we go. Hello, James. Thanks for joining us.
Hello.
How are you doing?
I'm very good, thank you. Very well.
Very, very kind of you to take time. You're literally on set, is that right?
I've stepped off set. I'm in office next to set.
Amazing. Well, we can't thank you enough for joining us. So could you tell us a little bit about what is an art director and a production designer, which seem to be the two monikers to your name?
Yeah, so I've worked both roles. So there's a kind of distinct hierarchy to the art department on a feature film. So at the top of the pyramid is the production designer, who basically is runs the department and creates the design look for a film. And then beneath the production designer are art directors. So our role, an art director's role is then to take on a brief from the designer and to look after a number of sets from a number of sets within the film. So you might, there might be like four or five art directors, and we'll divvy up. There might be 60 sets, so we'll have, you know, 10, 12 sets each. So that's kind of how it works as an art director. And then below the art director is an assistant art director. And then you have drafts men and women, and you have junior draftsmen, and you have art department assistants. And so there's this very, film is all about hierarchy. There's a very distinct hierarchy. So I production designed... Well, I've been doing this 21 years. So I started off as a runner, made my way up to art director on big feature films. Then I production designed for 10 years. I'm now back art directing. I've been back art directing for 3 years on big features again. And I'm currently working on Mamma Mia 2.
Oh, amazing. And would you be happy to name drop any of the features that you maybe have worked on over the last few years?
Yeah, so I worked on a Disney adaptation of The Nutcracker last year. That's coming out Christmas 2018. That was pretty crazy. That was amazing. Huge, great film sets and big fantasy film. That was fun. And then before that, I worked on The Mummy, the Tom Cruise Mummy. I was on that for a year. I designed the entire – I was looking after the plane crash sequence, which was brilliant fun. I love that, making rotating sets and floating around in zero gravity and – that was fun. And then I've worked on Love Actually, Tim Burton's Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, Oliver Stone's Alexander. Done quite a few films.
That's amazing. That's really great. Thanks. And so let's take a normal or a standard project. At what stage would you normally be brought on board?
Well, look, as an art director, I'd be brought on about 2 or 3 months into a project. As a production designer, it's probably best talking about a production designer because they kind of run the design look for a film. So a production designer comes on really early. So you'll be contacted before the film's gone into production or gone into prep, and you'll have meetings as a production designer before any studios are booked, before any offices are booked. And you'll have lots of conceptual meetings about how the film should look, et cetera. So what happens is, as a production designer, you do get contacted for quite a few projects. And some of these projects just bubble away for years, whereas others come out of the blue and suddenly want you to start the following Monday. It's a funny old industry. As production designer, you come on really, really early, and it'll literally be just you, you and the director and the producer, really, and then the director of photography will come on a little bit later.
Okay. And so do you, I guess at that point, then you're, do you get handed scripts to read through, or are you...
Yeah, that's kind of, that's the one thing you have in common is the script. So even before you get the job, the first thing you do is get sent a script. And quite often when you go for a meeting, for a production. While I prep, I put mood boards together. I might do some sketches. And I'll present a vision for that film, which is a bit tricky at times because the director and the producer might have a very strong vision of their own. I'm just a believer in they want a designer who has ideas. So you've got to be kind of quite adaptable. You've got to think on your feet in the meeting, because if you listen to what they're talking about and you look at your work and think, my God, I'm on a completely different tangent, you've got to adapt and think on your feet very quickly to kind of stay on side. But no, it's all about presenting your idea and you hope that they love your ideas. When it works, it's brilliant. I've worked with directors who just who love what you do, and you can do no wrong. And it's the nicest thing, because you're just spending their money and building amazing sets and having fun. And the flip side is you sometimes work with directors and you have nothing in common with them at all, and it's quite a slog. But that's life, isn't it?
Yeah, I can imagine that in the first instance that can be pretty exciting.
That's great.
So I guess, do you prefer working with a director who has a very specific vision, or someone who steps back and kind of gives you a blank canvas and lets you run with your ideas?
I like someone with a vision who then will let me run with my ideas, to be honest. It's good to have a vision because, I think you need to be, and if it's a common held vision as well, or it's one that you can kind of elaborate on together, that's brilliant. I find it very hard when, I have worked on productions where a producer has had a very distinct vision as to how a production should be produced, and my vision as a designer was slightly different, and it was pretty arduous. So, answering your question, someone with a very, very strong vision who's inflexible is really hard work. So I don't mind someone having a vision, as long as they're prepared to give you a brief and then let you run with it, because we all interpret things differently. And one design could be good as another. It's all one design is as valid as, it just depends how you interpret it, really. There's not a lot of right and wrong about these things.
Sure. So, I mean, as you know, we're trying to write the first ever podcast written feature film. And one of the big things we've been talking about this week is the look and feel of the cul-de-sac that our feature is set in. And sure. we were kind of going back and forth about how much control the writer would potentially have when it came to getting the script produced anyway. So from your experience, do writers tend to keep any kind of input at the stage where the script has been sold and been handed off?
It depends to what extent it's been handed off, if you know what I mean. If you're just, because I think writers, I mean, especially you think about kind of American TV shows, you have these showrunners, and quite often they're script writers. You think of the Duffer brothers, isn't it, who are doing Stranger Things. That's, I mean, they wrote a lot of that, and they have complete creative control. So, no, it's your baby as a writer. I think you can be traditionally, you might be handing over a script, but you can certainly be forthright in terms of what you're looking for, definitely.
Sure. And stay as part of the process, I guess, is something that we'd be keen on. So going back to that, so when you sit down, so you've received your script, you may create some mood boards. And in fact, could you just explain what a mood board is?
The mood board, I'll read a script and just think about the different characters in a film and the environment in which they inhabit. And have discussions with the director, for example. And then mood board will sum up the look for that set. So I will scour the net for photos. And some can be quite non-specific. Some might be about mood and colour and tone, because colour palette is very important. And you might assign different colours to different characters and different tone and different moods of the film. And then that might be quite specific about different types of architecture. If it's someone's study, if it's a professor's study, you might put images of a study. But I mean, a study can be created in so many different ways. So you put in literal images of how you think it will look by scouring the net. And the net is brilliant now. It used to be I'd have to go to bookshops. I used to go up to the West End and literally spend a couple of days just trawling through all the bookshops up there, kind of foils and the large Waterstones and things, just looking for interesting books and just flicking through. I spent so much money. I'd buy a, you know, a £40 book for one photo. Yeah, because those images are, I'm sat here in the room now looking at all the mood boards for Mamma Mia, and it is, yeah, it's just little photos of, you know, of a painted wall with some flowers hanging against it. And it's just, they're just, you know what it's like, one photo can sum up so many kind of feelings and emotions. So mood boards are very important for just getting the tone right and the look for each individual set. So they're basically, they're a collage, to get to the crux of it, they're a collage of images.
And that's how, and you would sit together, or that would be quite an insular process, or would you sit together with the producer or the director and break down the script using mood boards?
Well, I would break it down on my own. So I'd write, I mean, to be really literal, so I'll sit with the script open and I will just write a list out in Word of all the different sets, just list them all out. And then you'd pick three or four key locations or sets, and then maybe scribble some ideas down and get some references together. And I'd mount them up on a board, and I just do it all in Photoshop, to be honest. And I usually present them as A3 boards.
Amazing. Okay. And do you use, I guess we've touched on this a little bit, but are there any other visual tools that you kind of fall on?
Early on, no, because, I mean, it's almost too early to do SketchUp or anything like that, 3D software. I do little pencil drawings, to be honest. They kind of tell the story. You can keep it really loose at the early stage, really loose. It's only later on down the process that you start producing, you know, 3D models and carb models and renderings.
Okay, so James, how would you go about creating a set?
So you take those mood boards. So you take it's all about your initial ideas. So, you know, director signs off on your amazing vision for this concrete bunker with water reflecting on the walls, rather like Blade Runner. And so you sign off on your vision, and then I'd do some sketches. So I would sit with my pencil and just do some really rough sketches of how I'd want to do it. So 3D sketches. And then I trained as an architect, and I kind of see the world in plan, section and elevation. So I'll draw out some little rough plans and some rough elevations. And what I used to do, I'd take those, scan them and whack them into SketchUp and just have the crudest 3D model just from my sketches, which is quite handy. But what I would do then, I'd hand my sketches to one of my team and I'd get them to work those up into a more solid design. So I'll give them references, I'll give them my sketches and my scribbles, and I'll give them a few days, and they'd work up some elevations and a floor plan, and then we could create a white carb model of those, of the set. So it's all to scale. And these days, probably also get it put in, you'll get someone to make it a 3D model of it. So the easiest thing to use is SketchUp, because it's so quick. But we might use, some people use Maya, some people use Rhino, is a new one, Rhinoceros 3D. Some people use 3D CAD. Anyway, we will keep everything really fast and loose and make very quick 3D models and very quick 3D carb, physical carb, white carb models. So you can actually, the great thing about a white carb model is it'll be like, you know, 2 foot square in your hands, and you can pick it up and look at it and move it around, and you can have a director stood with you and a cameraman, and you can and literally just pull bits apart and move it around. And so it's a really easy way to work on a set. Now, when people kind of like the direction it's heading in, on these big films, you'll probably hand over the simple 3D model to an illustrator, and you get them to work it up into some beautiful photorealistic render of the set that you're after. I mean, I haven't done so much of it lately, but I quite often used to just do pencil renderings myself and just keep them completely monochrome. And they're always quite effective. But these days, especially on these big films, the visuals are almost photorealistic. So you hand them on to artists and they'll work with photo textures and drop Tom Cruise in, whoever you want in the image. And then that'll be your final presentation piece will be a couple of beautiful renders, a 3D model and a card model. So that's kind of the process. And then once you finally, then the model itself, so the set design itself, they'll go through changes and there'll be requests from the director, et cetera, and you'll spend a few weeks making changes. And then once it's signed off, you'll assign an art director to that set, or he or she will already have been assigned to that set, and they'll start drawing up working drawings. So it's all plan sections, elevations, and you design every nut and bolt in that set, you know, overall plans and elevations, and every doorway, every window, every stair, every little element, the skirt. I'm looking at just a door now. So you design the skirting and then the architrave around the door itself, the paneling of the door, and yeah, everything. It's amazing.
Wow.
It's all bespoke.
So how big's your team? I mean, there must be a...
It depends, really. On something like The Mummy, there must have been 40 of us in the art department. It's massive. It was a big film. Yeah, and then you hand it over to construction, the construction team, and there could be like 200-300 people in the construction team. So you hand it over to the construction manager, and then he'll hand it over to his head of carpentry and head of sculpture. We'll have a team of sculptors working for us. You know, if it's a mummy, they'll be carving great, fantastical Egyptian statues, and then we'll have plasterers creating rock faces for us, and you know, the carpenters making a structure, and they'll be doing nice joinery and things. Then you have the scenic painters coming in who will make, you know, a bland bit of wood or a bit of white plaster look like a lichen covered rock or a beautiful bit of paneling. Wow. They'll paint wood grain on it, and it is amazing. The people you work with, especially on these big films, are so talented. It's quite amazing. But there's hundreds of them. It's amazing. So as a designer, you have an overview of it all, but you have to be quite hands-off, and you can't just give people a nudge here and there. And then as an art director, which is what I'm doing now, I've got like, on Mamma Mia, I've got, I guess, 10, 11 sets. And so I have to see sets right through from the inception right through to them. I'll be down on the film set after lunch, just checking on the progress of a set that's being built at the moment. So you get really involved with the nitty gritty of the building process. And I have to go around and kind of quality control it and ask them to, you know, paint something. If something's not been finished quite correctly or the colours aren't quite right, I have to kind of give an opinion on it. So it's, yeah, incredible detail it goes into.
Do you watch all of your work or your previous work? And how would you say that you learn and progress from project to project?
It's not often I watch what I design, because you see, you'd like live and breathe it for like 6 months or a year. And then you sit and watch all the rushes, like the daily rushes and the daily footage. And yeah, it's funny. So often I don't end up watching it. It's a very strange thing. But you do see the footage. It's not like you don't see how it appears on film. And half the time you're sat on set anyway, watching the monitor. Yeah, I am a bit naughty for not watching the final results.
No, I think that sounds sensible. Do you do you watch? Are you sat there on set through the whole process?
No, I'm not. It's funny. I've only noticed recently. Some designers do sit on set a lot. I don't. It's not my. Well, I don't particularly enjoy being on set for that amount of time, because my job is all about creating. As a designer, it's about creating a vision and a set and an environment. As soon as the film crew turn up, I've kind of done all my work. So if the film crew turn up, you'll turn up at about 7:30 in the morning. You'll have a call time on camera for 8:00. So I'll meet the director there about 7:30, and I'll walk him through the set. And then he might want a few changes. Oh, let's move a bit of furniture around, and we'll make some changes. So that might take a couple of hours. And I'll hang around until they film the first shot. But there's nothing. That's it. What more is there for me to do? What you do have is, I do have a member of the art department with the film crew. They're called a standby art director, and they will look after the set and make sure it looks fantastic for every single shot that you take. Because what happens is, if you're in a room, to get the camera in one end, you have to take all the furniture out to create room for the the camera to be looking the other way. And of course, then they'll want to move the camera to the other end of the room, and you have to strike all the furniture from that end of the room and put all the furniture back in from the other end that you'd already taken out. So it's kind of just maintaining the set, making sure it looks as good as it should look. And also the standby art director will work with the director of photography in terms of framing shots and, you know, bringing elements in left and right. I personally don't think a production designer should be sat there framing shot after shot, because I think my job is to prepare the sets ahead of the unit. Because, you know, when the film unit is on a set, I've got another 70 to be designing and getting ready. So I'll make sure they're happy. I'll head off at 10 o'clock and you're off to getting the next one ready. So I just kind of hand it over to the film unit, really. And also, I think that I know some designers get really hung up about people making changes to their sets. Like, I didn't put the sofa over there, I wanted it over here. And it's like, well, I think it's a load of nonsense. You know, the film set is there for the director and for the cameraman, and it's for them to you know, it's their little playground. And I just, at times it can be a bit frustrating when they start messing around with things. So it's also nice not to be there, and then you don't have to get disappointed. So, yeah.
Yeah, you don't have to see people touching your work, I suppose.
Also, the film crews are horribly disrespectful of film sets as well, so that always breaks my heart. Within 5 minutes, there'll be coffee cups around the set and water bottles and people with their feet up on the furniture, and it's just, I find it's so, and that always breaks my heart, so I'd rather not be there.
Oh, no. Have you ever had any kind of like nightmares where you've had problems on set, or any major hiccups along the way?
Any major hiccups?
No one accidentally set fire to anything.
No, you hear about people burning down film stages and things, but have I had any? Not really. Come back to me on that one. I'll have a little think.
Well, I guess one of the big things we try and do every fortnight is we try and suggest films, so recommendations of films that are relevant to the episode that we've been talking about. So from your viewpoint, could you recommend any films that have particularly great visuals or that resonated with you or you used as kind of inspiration perhaps over your career?
Yeah, like I'm a real fan of Wes Anderson. I love Wes Anderson films. So an obvious one would be The Grand Budapest Hotel, which probably a lot of people know about because that's been Wes Anderson's most successful film. That came out a couple of years ago. I also love The Royal Tenenbaums, which is one of his early films. And before that, which might be slightly more inspiring to your listeners, is a film called Rushmore, which is one of his early films, which has a bit more of a low-budget feel about it. But every shot in those films, it's like a painted picture. The camera's always very static. The frame's always very symmetrical. And all the sets are hyper-real. They're all hyper-stylized, which isn't always the best thing to do at all when it comes to a film set, because you don't, more often than not, you don't want the set to overpower the actors. But I love the way he makes the sets as big a character as the actors themselves. They're all incredibly over-stylized, amazing palettes, amazing wallpapers, amazing furniture choices. Yeah, I find them a real joy to watch in that sense.
And do you think he's probably, I imagine that that's his vision, do you think, on his film? Is it as much of a give and take with the art department, or I always get the feeling that he knows where he's going.
He knows exactly what he wants. He used to get, I saw an interview with his production designer once, and he said, Wes Anderson gets his brother to do little sketches. And so quite often when you watch a film like The Royal Tenenbaums, they'll be like in the wallpaper for one of the rooms, is like almost like a naive childlike sketch of some animals leaping and that sort of thing. They're all sketches his brother does. So his brother does these little sketches of rooms and things. And they are quite innocent drawings, quite almost look like they're quite childlike, and that is what the set has to look like. It's quite amusing. So I think you certainly got to get on board if you're going to work with Wes Anderson and kind of embrace that look and feel. So maybe it will be a real challenge working with him. I don't know, but I love that look and feel. I'd love to work with Wes Anderson. I think they're great. Yeah.
Yeah. No, me too. I'm certainly a big fan. That's a great recommendation. So Rushmore, I've not seen it. We'll make that our recommendation for this week?
Go for it. Rushmore's good stuff. It's all in a similar vein, but yeah, and that's quite interesting because he obviously made that with very little money and somehow convinced Bill Murray to come on board. Yeah, it's got the usual Wes Anderson regulars in it. I think Jason Schwartzman's in it. And yeah, it's good. It's good stuff. It's fun.
Amazing. Well, this has been really great, James. One question that I have had, one question that's popped into my mind is, do you always work with, do the sets that you design, are they generally like real world scale? Have you ever done any kind of model work?
I tell you what I did do was when I did Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, we had to do stuff that was at Oompa Loompa scale. And an Oompa Loompa was 2'6" high. So we had to overscale. So, and the actor, this is really confusing. So if you say an actor, and a typical man is 6 foot high, and an Oompa Loompa was 2'6" high, and then the actor we had playing the Oompa Loompas was a guy called Deep Roy, and he's 4'4". So there was the height, the scale difference from 4'4" to 2'6", which was like, I don't know, 40%. So we had to make all these enlarged sets for this guy who was pretending to be an Oompa Loompa. So it made him look like he was 2'6" high. So that was a bit of a, that messed your head up a bit.
That sounds amazing. It sounds like a mathematical nightmare.
Oh, it was awful. No, it was quite good fun, actually. I quite enjoyed that. Have I worked with any miniatures? I don't think I have worked. I tell you what I watched last night was Blade Runner 2049. And that was interesting because you could tell that a lot of those cityscapes were miniatures. I haven't done that in years because everything's CGI. So that was quite interesting. So it certainly kind of gave you the feel of the original Blade Runner from 1982. But I watched it in IMAX, and I did sit there thinking, oh, look, the camera's flying over a load of little model buildings. Anyway, that was just an observation.
Well observed. I think the thing that was exciting for me about the new Blade Runner was the soundtrack was just immense.
Wasn't it incredible? Brilliant.
And I didn't feel like there was any CGI that took me out of the experience.
It's as much about what you didn't see as what you do see, isn't it? Yeah. Especially, you know, the end with that sort of desert scape. It was quite amazing, beautiful.
Yeah. Or when he's going into Las Vegas. Mad Max, I suppose, but
yeah,
just incredible. I'm actually a little bit jealous. I went to see it at the Picture House in Central London, where the sound system's incredible, but I imagine on the IMAX it was pretty intense.
Yeah, the seat was vibrating, and yeah, that was great. It was quite an experience. Very unusual film. I'm not surprised a lot of people haven't got it because I love the fact they spent so much money on a little art house film. It was like a massive art house film, isn't it? Really?
Yeah.
But I thought it was great. Yeah.
Oh, well, maybe we can add that. I guess it's a tricky one to add as a recommendation, but we haven't actually touched on it yet. And I know that Ryan and Tiernan will have some notes to add because I think we all geeked out a little bit over that film.
Yeah, it's easy to geek out over that film. It is a film geek smell.
It certainly is, yeah.
You know, I've never seen the original Blade Runner. I've only ever seen the director's cut. I think I've seen snippets of the original and I just couldn't stand that voiceover. So I turned it off.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I've never really thought about it.
Maybe there you go.
Oh,
pause for thought.
Amazing. Well, I'm super excited to maybe be able to come and visit you at some point. It sounds like there's a million things going on.
Yeah, it is exciting. Even I find it exciting going on the set still. And then obviously the film crew turn up and ruin it. So then I walk away. Don't put your coffee cup on that.
I've designed that. I've designed every nut and bolt in that.
Yeah.
I can imagine that really is a baby for you.
That's the end. And I think that's part of the reason you don't kind of end up watching it half the time because it's so involved. I cannot tell you. I mean, on The Mummy, I spent a year designing one plane. And the plane was rotating this way and rotating that way. And it was just... It was bonkers.
You could have just bought one off Turbo Squid. That saved you 12 months, I would have.
We could have just bought a real plane and cut it up.
Yeah, I suppose.
But
so.
Then the plane. But then we needed a soft version, so the stuntmen can roll around in it, and Tom Cruise can bounce around in it. There's all these sort of things to consider.
Yeah. Incredible, James. I don't want to take up too much more of your time, and you've also already given me 35 minutes of incredibly interesting stuff.
And again, thanks, James, for sparing the time to talk to us. It was a really, really great conversation, and we appreciate you giving up your lunch break. And also thanks for the recommendation of Rushmore. So I think that takes us on to recommendations.
As always, too many.
Yeah. As always, we won't watch them.
I will lead once again with American Vandal and Mindhunter, because I have just watched them. So then yeah. I can actually talk about them and everything else. Don't really know what relevance they have to a multi-stranded narrative about a hosepipe band, but sure, I can segue in somehow.
I guess so. American Vandal's kind of multi-stranded, and it's definitely funny.
Yeah.
And real.
And dark as well. Yeah. So yeah, the tonality of that. So yeah, it's good. And then Life is Beautiful was the other one.
La Vie est Belle.
From what I watched this week. Fantastic.
Great.
Yeah.
I'm going to go with my favourite, which is The Goonies.
And The Goonies Never Say Die.
Never Say Die. Break. Fall.
So next week, what is next week?
Well, next week, again, as before, we want to give ourselves a little time now to write Act Two, which is a big chunk. Again, probably we're looking at, you know, 40 pages or so. So we thought we'd maybe break it up with a little fun episode about casting, because I think we know our characters now. There's potential for a little change amongst them, but we've decided on our houses and our maid leads and the people we're going forward with. So we can talk about how we would... maybe take that to a casting director, what they'd be looking for in terms of notes and character breakdowns to pass on to actors, you know, who we'd like to see in those roles. Maybe we'll do a little wish list. And then maybe we'll try and get someone in to chat about casting and how that whole process works and what kind of how auditions work and what actors look for. I'm sure Ryan will have thoughts on that. And
none.
No. Blank canvas for casting. But yeah, so hopefully that'll be a little fun intermediate episode whilst
I'm excited.
Yeah.
But between now and then, you can find us, as always, online, spreading our musings via the Twitter sphere.
Mm-hmm. At A Film In That or Instagram.
There's A Film In That.
And you can get to all of that stuff through our website, www.tafit.co.uk, T-A-F-I-T.co.uk.
Yeah, Roy.
Yeah. Oop.
Well, that's another one down, lads.
Yeah,
good hustle.
Yeah.
Let's drop a beat.
You know I got a 50-year-old lady. I'm 22. I know that does sound scary. But guess what? It doesn't mean a thing. On a Sunday, we sit down and watch Lord of the Rings. I press play on her Toshiba Tele. 22-inch, I need to wear my spectacles. Nothing gets as hot as seeing all those hobbits. Apart from eating Ye Olde Valley mango yogurt. She's making shepherd's pie for me. I love it when she cooks my tea. It's Sunday, know what that means? It's creme brulee. Hey, you got to get to the prancing pony. My lady knows the word, so I know it can't be phony. We've seen the film every single Sunday since her husband died. Back to the movie, yeah, it's really going on. Frodo, Bilbo, and Aragorn. I turn to tell her that this next bit is the best. She's asleep. Well, I guess she really needs her rest. She's making shepherd's pie for me. I love it when she cooks my tea. It's Sunday, know what that means? It's creme brulee. I'm a virgin.